Oh, I just started recording. There you go. Let me pray. Father, thank you for this day. Lord, we pray that your blessing would be on everything that we do today, even as we talk about these subjects and how the name of your son and your church is often ridiculed in this world because of real evil that professing Christians commit. So Lord, let us have the right mindset. Let us be able to separate historical fact from myth and at the same time not get caught up in a defense of things that that ultimately do not speak accurately about you, but let us think critically about what does and what brings you glory and honor. So Lord, do that for us today. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So this one is basically going to be called God's Battalions. In the syllabus it was, the only thing I've added is a question mark. Because, that comes from a title of a book that we're going to talk about that came out recently by Rodney Stark called God's Battalions. So we are going to be doing some historical myth debunking. But don't confuse that with we're dividing up teams and they're our team and the other team is the liberal team. And it's a little bit too simplistic. So, session one, Crusades. Session two, Inquisitions. And in a lot of ways, the Inquisitions were really just the inward directing of the crusading impulse at that time. So you might remember from a previous session where we talked about the Muslim inroads into Northern Africa and into Europe, that they were called the Saracens at that time. That just meant Arab. That's the word that was used at that time. And they had pushed further into the eastern boundaries, as well as made their way onto the Italian peninsula. So it wasn't simply the Middle East and Northern Africa and Spain that were taken in the 7th century, but also all of the Mediterranean islands and much of Italy by the end of the 9th century. So let's draw that on the map. You remember, this is really sloppily drawn today, but you get the idea, that after the 7th century, going from Mecca to Medina and then on the Caliph Omar, they took over the Persian Empire, and by the end of the 7th century, got all the way up to the borders of Byzantium, and they didn't stop there. They were stopped there by a series of military routes, but they had taken over, and then formally, these were Christian kingdoms, and granted, they were monophysite Christians, but in Ethiopia and Sudan, but then they went all the way west, and you remember the Moors were those that crossed the Iberian Peninsula and even southern Spain and were stopped only at the battle in 732 by Charles Martel, Battle of Tours, and that's the only reason they stopped going that way. Well, they took over all these different islands, Sicily, and there's a bunch of other islands I didn't draw in there, but they took over those two, and at times were occupying the Italian Peninsula as well. So a lot of people don't know that. Well, that's going to be important for obvious reasons as we get to in a second here. So these were Christian lands inhabited by Christians, with the exception of the Arabian Peninsula. Everywhere else were inhabited by a Christian majority. These places were invaded in the 7th and 8th century and taken over by the beginning of the 9th century, all occupied by Muslim invaders, all taken over by violent means. Today we would call that imperialism. When the West does that, that's called imperialism. When Islam does it, it's called an Arab sport practiced by most Arab males at that time, by their historians, by Western liberal historians, excuse me. So with these European territories coming under increasing military consolidation, there was a check and reversal that was underway by the 9th and 10th century. Constantinople was successfully defended from a major siege way back in 672, which some historians have regarded to be as pivotal of a historical event as the battles of Thermopylae and Salamis in the ancient world when the Persians were attacking the Greeks. And it was for the same basic reason. If the eastern capital fell, it would have opened up the way for Muslim armies to penetrate Europe from the east by land. One eastern historian even commented that, quote, had they captured Constantinople in the 7th century rather than the 15th, all Europe and America might be Muslim today, end quote. So it's one of those things that makes you realize that would have radically altered history as the Holy Roman Empire was consolidating. If they had won this battle here, they would have attacked through the east 8 centuries before they did, and we would all be wearing burkas or lampshades if we're not too happy about that. Girls, burkas, men, lampshades. There you go. The Muslims tried to invade twice more in 717 and then following in the next spring, and each time they were repelled in Constantinople by the firing of a precursor to napalm bombs, simply called Greek fire at the time. And you can make napalm, which I will not tell you how because I'm being recorded. Italy and Spain were regained in full between the years 1085 and 1248. And what about the difference between the two cultures? There was a clash of civilizations going on there that was intellectual first, in a sense. There's the idea of a high Arab culture at this time. The Kalam school was their theological school, similar to the Western Scholastic school. And it was basically a Muslim, and you don't want to say it in an uncharitable way, but facts are facts. Even the Arabic numeral is not really the Arabic numeral. It is a Hindu invention, and B, introduced to even the Arab lands by Nestorians, by Christian monks. So it's really nothing Arabic about it, except for the fact that they were the ones who presided over its spread through the Western world. But the unpopular but obviously true truth is that what the Moors brought into Spain and what the provincial Muslim elites held over the local unconverted people, and they had a name for the unconverted people. They, as late as the 20th century, and I'm sure they still do, think of the West as barbarians and uncivilized. They would call the locals the dhimmis. Might as well call it, I guess it was a word for the dummies, in a sense, because it was the local people who were unconverted, in other words, unconverted to real culture, Muslim culture. But really, that was nothing but classical Christian culture translated into Arabic, mostly by local Jews and Christians, intellectuals, monks. Islam originated nothing of the kind, not science, not those numerals that I mentioned, not theology or philosophy. And the inferiority of its actual manifest culture began to be proved out in the theaters of war. Yes, the Muslims did have direct access to the Greek tradition of philosophy, to mathematics, and to science, but with few notable exceptions, they failed to understand what they were looking at. Their scholars set to work on reconciling Islam to Greek from the end of the 7th century through the High Middle Ages. In other words, the Kalam school had been at it for 400 years when these texts were just being translated into Europe. There was an advantage. They did have access to not all of Aristotle's works. Some of Aristotle's works were known through the first couple centuries, and all of Plato's were. But there was a couple of them that were translated, the majority of them, that were translated into Arabic first before they were translated back into Latin. So they did have a head start, but it's a bit like some meteor falling from another planet and them wondering what to do with it. And they did translate it, and they did add their own commentaries and stuff like that. And I'm only mentioning that, not to bust on them or anything like that, just to reverse some historical revisionism, that there was this not only liberal in the sense of charitable and humane civilization, but that it was an advanced civilization that originated from their mind. That is simply not the case at all. So none of the inferences that they made from this philosophy that had dropped into their lap was really progressive in character. As one 11th century Muslim author observed, quote, this is a Muslim at that time, saying, truly the scribes here in Syria, as is the case of Egypt, are all Christians. And it is most usual for the physicians to be Christians. So they recognized that at the time in their own lands. It was really Christians and Jews that were the physicians and that were the philosophers and the translators and those that explained this culture to them. So we're going to have more to say about the clash of intellectual cultures later, especially next week. But now, there was the idea that Christians have the duty to defend a continent, not just against ideas, but against invading armies. A continent on which they had previously been huddled together by virtue of their division and intellectual darkness. As one British historian put the basic European outlook, he said, quote, the popes, like most Christians, believed war against the Muslims to be justified partly because the latter had usurped by force lands which once belonged to Christians, and partly because they abused the Christians over whom they ruled and such Christian lands as they could raid for slaves, plunder, and the joys of destruction. So the idea was defensive in the minds of those Christians. Okay, so Christians now, when I say huddled, they were existing within the Frankish domain, the Saxon domain, of course the British, and northern Italy, and there's a sort of a middle ground Eastern-Western Christianity practiced by the Slavs, and those that were still, to the degree that there was Christians in Constantinople and in the Eastern Church. But that's the extent of what Christian civilization, they were very much divided at this time. But this idea of defense wasn't the only idea, of course. In fact, one of the best things that historical revisionism has going for it is that it takes things that are true. It's like the devil, you know, we saw that back in the Truth Project, how historical revisionism is one of the oldest forms of lies or propaganda that there is. I mean, what was the devil ultimately doing when he said, you know, did God really say? He was lying. That's what historical revisionism is. It's lying about something that just happened or happened in the past, as Karl Marx says, so that you can make people believe whatever you want them to. Because if you can convince people that you got here to this place from these series of events, you pretty much control the kind of world that people think is there. That's what's at stake here. It's not to defend the Crusades per se, because there's so much that is indefensible. There were other ideas here, not just defense. There was the potential for material gain and earthly prestige, which is never absent from the company of even the best causes. You show me a good war, take World War II, and I will show you people that were abusive on the right side. Okay, so it's a mixed bag, and you can always have somebody come in there to say, ah, look at that. They had these motives. You're going to defend that? Well, what happened is, in the 18th and 19th century, the Enlightenment began to propagate that this whole event, that these motives of gold digging and setting up a name for yourself and converting people by the sword, Western imperialism was the whole root and branch of it. And that thesis was seductive to both liberal Protestants, who weren't happy about either Catholicism or Orthodoxy, and modern secularists alike. More recently, it's been taken for granted that the Arab people, quote, from one historian, were our first colonies. The Arab people at this time were our first colonies. Isn't it nice to know that you were there, first of all, and responsible for that? And that, quote, the Crusade acted as a kind of safety valve for the knightly class, the knights in Europe. In fact, the church at this time was pretty realistic about the knights' ingrained need to be in some kind of fight, any fight. They were kind of like Europe's first gangs. The idea, in fact, of chivalry at that time wasn't like chivalry like you think of today, you know, opening doors for girls. That wasn't the idea. It was a glory-seeking that had to be in a fight to establish oneself, to establish glory. It was very secular. There wasn't a whole lot Christian about it. And it really already existed within the Frankish, Germanic way of life that simply, just like a lot of other pagan practices, co-opted Christian ideas to justify it. Well, the Pope, in a sense, was looking at this and saying, since you guys love killing anything that moves for your own namesake, why don't you direct your attention over here? It's kind of like the CIA, not to justify everything the CIA does, but it's kind of like the CIA using sordid characters to be informants, to infiltrate certain lands. It was the same kind of idea. You were taking a phenomenon of a tendency in people that already existed and transferring this ferocity to a holy cause. And of course, Rome added to that the notion of penitence by a just war. So you have the idea of just war, which, if you come to this for the first time, that may or may not be justifiable. But then you already mix it with this idea of gaining merit, penitence by engaging in this crusade. And this lesser vision, this perverted, polluted vision, dominated not only people at the time, but dominated our understanding of the Crusades in the modern world. For instance, one author, a guy named R.W. Southern, in his book, The Making of the Middle Ages, posed the question of the crusading zeal's origin by saying, quote, certainly it was not this zeal, certainly it was not born in the broader lands where Christian and Muslim met. In these lands, we find rather the spirit of live and let live. You know, except for the severed head. They would have maybe thought differently about it after that. Live and let live. A certain tentative friendliness, even, produced by the desire to avoid unnecessary trouble. The impulse to attack was generated further back, in the power centers of Europe, partly at Rome, partly among the great families of northern France, partly in prophetic souls. So church histories at this point are usually joined at the hip to the overall secular histories. For example, McCullough, in his book Christianity, sees this as a larger evolution of the Christian doctrine of war. He says, quote, the difference now, in other words, by the 11th century, was that Christian warfare could actually be seen as the means to win salvation. Now, that's true in a lot of people's minds, and that's true in what the Pope was selling to people. But this would hold for the converts to be made out of it, as well as for the merit accrued by the soldiers for Christ. By contrast, when historians deal with the Muslim side of things, Muslim aggressions were aberrations. So in the same book, it says, so in 1099, the mentally unstable Caliph al-Hakim of Egypt ordered the systematic demolition of Constantine's Basilica of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. That was one thing that really outraged. It became this sort of spark that outraged people in the West. You say, so when this happened, it was the result of one lone mentally deranged Muslim individual. When the Europeans did, it was a systematic way of thinking that built for centuries. It's the way they think. You open up this book, the Bible, you get this. But that has nothing to do with the Quran. It was just one twisted individual. That's the suggestion. So it was only an increased aggression of pilgrimage being promoted by the West. So ignore the crazy guy blowing up that sepulcher and picking off pilgrims. What's happening here is the West is just shoving pilgrims into this to incite this violence. Okay, so the West is stepping up this aggression of pilgrims going into Jerusalem. But at the moment of the First Crusade, one historian says, quote, there was no great immediate crisis to rally the West against Muslim aggression. So the whole chapter of history is set in the context of a century 800 or 900 years into the future. Now, mercifully, scholarship is no longer the airtight monopoly that it used to be from the Enlightenment to the end of the Cold War. So one example of debunking these myths recently is that book that I mentioned, Rodney Stark's book, God's Battalions. That was written in 2009, and as the subtitle suggests, it is a case for the Crusades. My class today is not a case for the Crusades. And we're debunking this historical revisionism because of all that's at stake in it, but it's certainly not a case for the Crusades. One might suspect that such a defense, in other words, Stark's defense, is inextricably joined to a similar defense of the current war on terror. In other words, if you're going to say good things about the Crusades, you obviously have the same mindset that would justify today's Crusades, such as they're the same thing. Well, such an inference is unwarranted on several accounts. Let me just mention two. First of all, in war, there's philosophical justifications as well as strategic disagreements. So in other words, even if a war is justified, it doesn't follow that its execution is beyond intellectual and moral criticisms. You can justify World War II philosophically, morally, but you can take issue with a lot of the different battles that were fought, both for intellectual reasons and for moral reasons. Nor does it follow that those who fought it were motivated by the same moral justifications that were the right ones. So you can justify a war, and you can see a lot of people in the theater of war that don't have the same motives you do, that don't have the right justifications. So a justified war being carried out in an unjustified way. Secondly, it would seem that the leaders of the West today, who organized the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, did their best to ensure us that religion has nothing to do with it whatsoever, not least the peace-loving religion of Islam. How many times in the first couple of weeks after 9/11 did George Bush use the phrase, peace-loving religion, peace-loving religion, peace-loving religion, peace-loving religion, peace-loving... This is a few people that have hijacked a peace-loving religion. We did everything... Now, I'm not saying that he should have made it a crusade or that he should have done it at all. But here you have a secular guy who demonstrated his ignorance of religion and comparative religion by making those statements. So you had a multifaceted lie about comparative religion being foisted by politicians who clearly had no understanding of what they were talking about. So that parallel is forced in a lot of ways. So as far as Stark's thesis is concerned, this case for the Crusades, it really is a classic case of undoing historical revisionism gone amok. He strikes all the right blows against the modern mythology about these events, but then he strikes his own sour notes in a defense for the notion that was held by the knights themselves. In other words, being God's battalions. That was what they believed. They did not believe that they were converting people by force. They did not believe they were invading Arab lands. In fact, Arab lands were here. These were what would, in the modern Arab mind, be called Turkish lands. And by the way, they didn't exactly like each other. That's going to be important later on, because there's a myth behind these myths that's even easier to miss, but I'll come back to that. Now, Stark is right in one sense. Such sympathy for the knight's position, or even the Pope's position, has its place. We're bad historians, and perhaps bad moralists, when we judge an action in the past, or an event, solely by the standards of our own time. But we should add, and I would say to Stark, that we are bad Christians if we don't make a practical judgment of the events and actions and seek to reform our lives by an eternal standard. So I'm not so much concerned to defend them against some modern, inapplicable standard. I'm also after the question, after I deal with the liberal who's rewriting history for his own purposes, I'm also concerned to judge what really was wrong with the Crusades by an eternal standard. If we're going to face a war in our lifetime, it's either going to be just or unjust. What's needed from Christians is more than a historian, but a saint. The question is not what we would have done in the 12th century. We're never going to be in the 12th century. As if our private opinion would have any currency anyway back then. The question is rather, what is true about God in all of these related thoughts and feelings and actions, and then how can we apply those truths to similar circumstances that we really do find ourselves in today? All sides in these questions usually miss the common thread that runs through the story of the Crusades and the Inquisitions, and this is really my big idea for today, for both sessions. From a Christian perspective, in these two nightmares of wasted history, the devil co-opted the church's pure teaching on just war and right reason, causing the wrong violence to be exerted and the right violence to be abdicated. Big long idea, let me write it down on the board. From a Christian perspective, in these two nightmares of wasted history, here's the big idea. In the Crusades and the Inquisitions, from these two things, here's the big idea. The devil, you can't write that. This is a scholarly treatment of history. Again, I'm coming from a Christian perspective, and I don't pretend to be coming from any other perspective. The devil, in these events, and therefore in the mind of his, in other words, it worked. The devil's ploy worked, because historians are talking about garbage. It has nothing to do with anything. Here's what happened. The devil co-opted the church's pure teaching. We have access, meaning the Bible's pure teaching. Not that the church is what makes that purity happen. The Bible says things about just war and right reasoning that are pure truth. So the church is entrusted with that. That's what I mean by the church's pure teaching. The church's pure teaching on two things, on just war, and that was, we were distracted from that by the Crusades, and right reasoning, the defense of right reasoning, and that was obliterated by the Inquisitions. And what was the fallout? What was the devil after? Causing the wrong violence to be exerted and the right violence, sorry that I'm writing so sloppily and small, the right violence to be abdicated, abdicating the responsibility to a true spiritual violence. What do I mean by that? Well, technically speaking, let me just defend that really quickly before I get into this timeline. Technically speaking, violence simply means, going back into the Greek and the Latin, violence simply means a transcendent, rational, volitional action against nature. Remember, in the Christian worldview, nature is fallen now. We're still called to be image bearers. A violent action is one that violates or runs contrary to the ordinary weight of the fall. Puritans would use the word violence all the time in a good way. Violently taking heaven by storm, Watson said. A violent act is one that violates or runs contrary to the ordinary weight of the fall. In other words, the fall of man. A violent motion is an upward motion. It's what distinguishes the human from the non-human. But violence has a counterfeit which looks radically different from the ordinary course of things. A lion feeding on a gazelle carcass and an impatient commuter punching somebody else who's waiting in traffic, each look violent, precisely in how they break the ordinary, comfortable routine. Both are uncomfortable to look at when you're sitting in your suburban living room. But that is an optical illusion of temporal comfort. In the biblical worldview, the ordinary is the falling. What's fallen, what's cursed, what's moving away from God is what's ordinary now. So that primal, essential violence is good, and corrupting violence is evil. What makes violence evil is that it's moving in the same direction as the fall, violating God's glory, the nature of things as they should be. But there's a violence upward against the fall and toward God's glory that's good and called for. Corrupting violence, the abuse of something that God made to speak about himself, is actually moving in the same direction as the fall. Which is why lions, in spite of the fact that the cameraman only shows it every once in a while, lions actually bite gazelles in the butt all the time. And humans would be punching their fellow humans in the face much more frequently if a higher violence was not suppressing them from doing so. That's what comfortable suburban man doesn't understand, which is why he does everything wrong and suppresses people that actually want to do things right. And it bothers people when people bring up stuff like this. It looks so violent. It takes a primal violence to suppress corrupting violence. But one's violence is only ever as good as what it says about God. It takes a primal, maybe this is a sub-big idea. This is what we don't accept today. It takes a primal violence to suppress corrupting violence. In other words, when you look at reality, you see people divided or mocking other people or persecution. You say, that's the result of violence. Wrong. That's the result of you cowards not acting in a primal violence. It's called dominion back in Genesis 1. You're being a coward and letting evil people abuse things and people. That's your fault. That's the church's fault. That's Adam's fault. That happens. Weeds grow because you're not picking weeds. Primal violence alone stops corrupting violence. Corrupting violence doesn't go away because we hold hands, sing kumbaya around the fire. Corrupting violence goes away only when somebody busts out a nightstick and handcuffs and puts them in jail. It's called dominion. The church of the 12th and 13th century were far removed from the biblical categories that make this intelligible. The result was two of the blackest marks that the body of Christ has ever displayed. But getting this right kicks the soapbox out from the feet of the deconstructionist, the historian, who would sell us all major worldview pieces in the package of this historical revisionism. A lot of worldview cargo is going to be moved on the train of the seemingly, you know, who cares? Who cares about the Christians? I'm not with them. I'm not with these Puritans that burn witches. I'm not with these Catholics. Good riddance to them. And so it seems irrelevant. It has nothing to do with it. Well, if you buy that, if you let that slide by, there's a lot more worldview pieces being smuggled into that than you might think. So let's look at this. Pope Urban II's selling point. He was the pope when this first broke out. His selling point to Europe's knights made bad theology in terms of penitence. But it doesn't follow that there was nothing just in the thinking that could have been happening about such a war. First of all, going on the crusade was expensive. So you hear all the time it was done for money. They knew from the beginning they would lose money. Going on the crusade was expensive. It was not obvious that there would be sufficient monetary returns, even to the temporal glory seeker. Oftentimes they had to bring their whole family. Two-thirds of the people that went were not knights or even armed. They were people going on a pilgrimage, and they now had an entourage. They had a bodyguard. But there were women and children. There were old people that would go. They made the trek across Europe and down into the thing. They had to bring their whole family. They had to bring their animals. They were transporting everything. Conceivably, as far as they knew, they didn't know they'd be there for 10 years. There wasn't money to be made. It was a sacrifice monetarily. Because of a handful of statements by exiled Christian groups in centuries before this, as the Muslims were pushing northward and westward, because of the statements of these fringe Christian groups, often Nestorians and Monophysites, that could be pulled out of context, the picture is often painted that the Muslim invaders slaughtered only those who resisted with violence. But there were many of the cities who understandably saw these armies precisely as foreign armies. And they did what people naturally do. They sought to defend themselves. So to say, well, they only slaughtered when people resisted, as if resisting was like the violent thing, and the people coming in would have just come with leaflets and flowers if they hadn't resisted violently, they sought to defend themselves. And in these armed conflicts, thousands were murdered each time. Note that these were citizens in their own cities being invaded. Notice that as that pink color goes westward and northward, that these are Arabs in the Arabian Peninsula imperializing the entire area, murdering, invading cities that are inhabited by Christians. Not only were they not Arab or Muslim cities, they were not neutral cities in between the two territories. They were inhabited by Christians. These were Christian peoples exterminated for 3 to 5 centuries. This is admitted in the books, but it's sort of explained a different way. It's arranged like a magic trick, a card trick maybe even, sleight of hand. So that it's all admitted, it's all there, but it's all rearranged on the board to tell a different story. In short, Islam invaded Europe and would have spanned the entire continent had they not been forcibly turned back. They occupied these lands as military provinces for at least 2, and in some cases 5 centuries. These facts, again, are admitted in the history books, but then promptly re-explained as something else. Within these territories, we're told, nobody was ever forced to be a Muslim. The Quran itself forbids forced conversion at first. Yet in being given the choice of conversion or enslavement or serf conditions, many converted as an external show. They didn't realize all that that entailed at first. But once you're considered a Muslim, conversion back from Islam to Judaism and Christianity is punishable by death. So in fact, there is forced conversion by sword, by increments. The entire leadership of a particular Christian village, for example, was rounded up in a church and burned to death in Armenia in 705. This was the common plight of Christians who resisted in any way. At this time, both Europeans and Arabs understood that where one army consisted of hired hands and the other of true believers, the strident of faith would win every time, regardless of the weaponry. It was a struggle of mercenaries versus militants. So the Christian vision had to be updated for the times. They understood that they were against an army that they could crush militarily, but they couldn't compete against because these guys believed in their worldview, and Christians did not. There's a parallel between that time and our time. First Crusade. Let's get into the First Crusade, and maybe I'll do the latter Crusades with the Inquisition. It'll probably work better with my notes anyway. Here's how this happened. There was a letter that was written to the West from the emperor of the Eastern Empire, Alexius Comnenus. He was in Constantinople and he sent this letter to Rome. It's basically a cry for help. The Muslims in the region were called the, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right, but the Seljuk Turks, and had pressed through the borders of the Eastern Empire all the way to within 100 miles of the capital. On their way through the Holy Land, so the letter said, and this is what the letter claimed, they had raped women, ritually split open stomachs to burn out entrails, and destroyed churches and homes. Pope Urban II took it seriously, and on November 27th, 1095, you say, well, he took it seriously. He wanted a crusade for a long time, and this gave him an opportunity. Okay, I'll grant that. Whatever. Sure. It kind of doesn't really matter. The point is that this was the rationale that he was using. Pope Urban II took this on November 27th, 1095, at a council in Clermont, France. He read the entire account to a large group in all of its gory detail. And he pled with the Western Christians to answer the call to stop fighting among themselves and to redirect their knights' training and mindless civil wars to the cause of driving out the Persians, as they were now being called. And the response was overwhelming, and the First Crusade was launched as an effort to defend the boundaries of peoples who had not provoked their enemies. But Europeans were not totally dependent on the Eastern and Western leadership for their information about the Muslim treatment of Christians on the frontiers. Thousands of pilgrims to the Holy Land were mistreated and often massacred for centuries. And those who lived to tell about it did so when they came back to Europe. Detractors and defenders of the Crusades alike focus on the liberation of the Holy Land as if it were some kind of neutral theme park in the middle. as if nobody lived there, and it was simply a floating object of religious controversy which Jew, Christian, and Muslim alike mindlessly shed blood over. You hear that all the time, popularizers of this view by people like Karen Armstrong. And all these liberal Westerners, these secularists, you would think would be the most frightened at Islam. But in fact, in the last 10 years, are its biggest defenders. Will do anything they can to twist any fact to show how Islam is a superior, peace-loving civilization and how Christians exterminated them and imperialized and went over their borders. When in fact, the very opposite happened, that these were not Muslim lands at all. There was no such thing as Islam until the 7th century. They were Arabs in this region. They were accepting Christianity and oftentimes Judaism, but at least Christianity. And these were Christian lands. They weren't even neutral lands. They were Christian lands. They were invaded, exterminated. I brought up the point 2 weeks ago that there were 40,000 Christians in this area at that time. 80 years later, there were 4,000. They were exterminated. Sometimes defenders of the Crusades will even ignore that fact or not see the significance of pointing out that these were not neutral territories even, where people, innocent people were killed. These were Christian lands that were exterminated and wiped out. There was no Muslim presence there prior to their imperialism of the entire region. So, and it was mostly inhabited by Christians, not even really Jews at the time, because Jews were not permitted to live in Jerusalem ever since the Roman Emperor Hadrian, his extreme reaction to the Bar Kokhba Revolution of 135. So the residence was pretty much Christian throughout those centuries. The Arab armies were comparatively small and were only successful because of their ability to maneuver and flank in the inhospitable desert sands. And this is what they did because of the excess of their camels. It was actually an advantage in those battles. After initial control of the Mediterranean Sea by the beginning of the 8th century, they quickly lost it to the more advanced ships and strategies of the renewed Byzantine Navy. Now, you're going to see that both the land forces, the heavy cavalry of the French especially, and the navies that are supplied sometimes by the Byzantine Empire, but then they become a bunch of traitors. But from over here, everything in war that normally would be to your advantage, with the exception of those tactics out in the desert, was in the West's advantage in all of the Crusades. But in every case, they were run by a bunch of incompetent weasels that didn't believe what they were doing in a unified way in the same sense as the East. That is something you see everywhere in the history of warfare. The side that believes that they have a right to exist wins every time. And the group of people who are led by the same weasels that write the textbooks rewriting the history don't. Whether it's a just war or not, and you look at the past couple of wars in America, certainly going back to Vietnam, you have people leading the wars who not only don't believe in the cause, but who in fact secretly believe in the cause of the enemy and putting thousands and millions of people into harm's way for a war that they believe the ideology of the other side. That's a pretty good red flag that you're not going to do well, even if you have military advantages. But this first group to take up the cross, that was as it was called at that time, in response to Urban's talk, was comprised of knights, but also a lot of elderly and women and children, against the strict warning of the Pope not to bring these who would hinder and slow things down. But they were led by a visionary prophet, self-proclaimed prophet, one of those guys, Peter the Hermit. I mentioned Walter the Penniless, but Peter the Hermit at that time. His talent was for rousing the people up into a frenzy. And while he was gathering another 20,000 from up north, several thousand French knights traveled across Europe to Byzantium to report for duty. This is going to happen the first three times. The crusade's going to get going. By the majority of the support is going to come from here and here, and they're going to report for duty, in a sense, in Constantinople, and then, once convening there, thinking that they're going to get together for a united Christendom, because after all, it was their emperor who asked for help. Certainly, he's going to pledge hundreds of thousands of troops. That's what they're thinking. And they're going to do this three times, and each time it's going to be a colossal failure. But all in all, 130,000 Europeans gathered for the first wave of combat. Not many forces of Byzantines were left to join them by that time. 40,000 knights and infantrymen launched out in June of 1097. The People's Crusaders, as they were called, were sent first from nearby Helenopolis. Nicaea had become the capital under the Turks. By the way, Constantinople and Nicaea very close to each other. Very close to each other. This was the capital by that time. The Muslims at the time were right here. So let me extend this. In those years leading up to the First Crusade, they were pretty much getting ready to take over what was left of the Eastern Empire. So this really was a defensive move, whether the Easterners really believed they had a right to exist anymore or not. That's another story that we'll get to. But Nicaea had become the capital under the Turks, and it was only 25 miles away. These people were untrained and were promptly slaughtered, these 40,000 that were sent out. There was no real strategy coming from the east. They were expecting that. But then those with real fighting experience and skill arrived throughout the following year, 1097. So little by little, portions of Asia Minor were returned to Byzantine control. They were winning battles little by little here and there and pushing them back. The main route into the Holy Land was from Nicaea to Iconium, eastward to Caesarea, down to Antioch, and then along the coast through Tyre toward Jerusalem. And during this trek, around 115,000 of the original 130,000 were lost to either death or retreat. So this was reversed in that short amount of time, but at the cost of 80% of the people that had journeyed. 80% of the people, when there's military victories going on this way, and 80% of your forces lose their life to groups that are a fraction of yours, you know that there's bad strategy going on. You know that there's not a unified picture of what we're doing here. Even with methods of warfare as primitive compared to today as they had back then. Last point on the first one. The crusading forces were still not exactly unified, even after this. There was a lot of people who were there, for example, the Normans, who were just there to set up their own kingdom. I won't get into this guy so much, not really important, but there was a decisive victory in Antioch on February 9th, 1095, but they pretty much spent the whole time fighting over who would be the king of that new city, and so they didn't go further to expel the Arabs out of the region altogether. But the emperor, the Eastern Emperor, Alexius, was essentially a stooge for the enemy, as they were going to begin to find out. He could have sent plenty of food, plenty of supplies, and backup, but he sent none of the above. And finally, additional soldiers arrived from England. They got a victory. It was a pretty hollow victory at that time. And all the while, a large force of Muslim warriors under the Turkish Sultan had been collapsing upon Antioch. Even there, though, the severely outmanned forces of heavy cavalry still proved superior. When I say that, I just mean they're arranging themselves. If you've seen Braveheart, you know that they're heavily armored, large spears, I mean, completely superior type stuff they were not used to. To charge into that by horseback alone, you're pretty much walking into this death trap. And so they just arranged themselves like that. And it wasn't until comparatively recently, 18th century, people are still aligning on battlefield this idea of a gentleman's war, and you always ask yourself, what the heck are they doing? Because by then you had cannons and stuff like that, and it just didn't make any sense anymore. But at that time it made a lot of sense to arrange yourself like that with spears and heavy armor when you're being attacked like that. You pretty much wouldn't be charged. You could charge the enemy without being charged. Again, hollow victory by February of 1099. The Pope died that summer before he got the news of the victory. But, one last thing on that. The Muslim population inside Jerusalem at that time, they didn't surrender, and thus they were massacred, which naturally furnishes a popular example of Western brutality, though it was just acting according to the rules of war. So there were cities when the Muslims invaded that the people, again, Nestorian monks, Monophysites, people in the East who wanted nothing to do with the West, they didn't know much about this new religion called Islam, and so they basically hedged their bets, and they just surrendered. And therefore, they were not slaughtered. The Muslims in the city did not surrender, and therefore were slaughtered. Now, if you're a thinking person, you realize, okay, that's just standard rules of war. The reason they were slaughtered was because they were combatants, not surrendering. The reason they were not slaughtered is because they gave up and surrendered. Now, as it turns out, many of them were slaughtered later by trying to convert back to Islam. So if you just use the brain there, you can realize that. But what typically is happening is that the historian is just pushing this through in high school classrooms, in college classrooms, on the History Channel, and nobody's really asking up any follow-up questions. Let me end the first session there, and then we'll get to the later rounds of Crusades and the Inquisitions. Any questions whatsoever on this stuff?